Hi, everyone. I'm Jen Malott, a partner in the antitrust practice at Freshfields in Washington and Brussels, and you're listening to the Essential Antitrust Podcast. I am delighted to be here today with my colleague Colin Raftery, who's a partner in our London office, who's here to talk about the new changes that have just been introduced to the UK Phase 2 merger review process and what those might mean for businesses who are facing in-depth merger reviews in the UK. As I'm sure many of our listeners know, Colin recently joined Freshfields from the UK Competition and Markets Authority, where he was Senior Director of Mergers for the past 5 years. So there's really no one better to give us the insider view on these new reforms.
Thanks, Jen, for such a warm introduction. It's great to be here to talk to you today about these changes.
Great. So, Colin, let's dive straight in. What is the CMA doing here and why are they doing it?
So, as many of your listeners will know, the CMA is one of those authorities that has a two-stage merger process. So it has a phase one initial investigation, which is intended to screen out non-problematic deals. And then the deals that are a little bit trickier go for an in-depth phase two investigation. That in-depth phase two investigation is not overseen by CMA staff. A set of independent decision makers come in to take the key decisions in the case, advised by CMA staff. And the CMA has faced a little bit of criticism in recent times about the process by which those investigations are run being a little bit rigid and formalistic and not providing for enough engagement with those new independent decision makers. So what the CMA has been doing over the last 9 months, it has been engaging in a little bit of a consultation exercise where it's been talking to a lot of businesses and economic advisors and legal advisors to try and understand what works well and what doesn't work well about the phase two merger process. As a result of that kind of quite broad program of engagement, it's come up with a number of proposals to quite significantly revamp that process for in-depth merger investigations.
So can you tell us a little bit about what those proposals are? Are these substantive? Are these process? Are they both?
I think it's important to be clear on what they are. They are procedural rather than substantive. So what that means in practice is they affect the way in which a CMA investigation is going to be run rather than the legal standards by which competition concerns and remedies will be assessed. But when thinking about that process, there are three main aspects to the reforms. So firstly, the CMA is trying to streamline the start of the process. So at the moment, the process is kicked off by what's called an issue statement, which is a new document where the independent decision makers come in and they set out what they think they're going to look at in the course of the case. That can kind of take a few weeks to get going. So it's not clear at the outset of the investigation exactly what the key issues are going to be. What is going to happen now instead is that the investigation is going to be based on the decision that the CMA issues at the end of the phase one investigation. So from the very outset, everyone is going to be clear what's on the table. On top of that, the CMA has formalized a couple of opportunities at the start of the process for the merging parties to have a teach-in, to teach the independent decision makers a bit more about the industries in which the case concerns, and then also an initial substantive meeting. So that provides a really early in-person opportunity for the merging parties and their advisors to go in and really tell the CMA's independent decision makers what they think about the deal. So that's the first set of changes, this kind of enhanced process to streamline the start of the process and get into the meat of the issues a little bit more quickly. The second thing the CMA is doing is revamping the main party hearing. So the main party hearing has been a part of the process which I think is fair to say has caused some frustration in recent years. It's really been an information gathering process for the CMA, which took place before it issued its provisional decision on whether the case raises competition concerns. What the CMA is going to do now, they're going to tweak that a little bit. So what's going to happen is the report setting out the CMA's provisional view on whether there are competition concerns or not, that's going to move forward a bit in the process. And then the main party hearing will now take place after the parties have seen that rather than before. So what that means is you have this revamped hearing where the parties have seen the entirety of the case against them, including, you know, a summary of the evidence upon which that case is based. So they have a really, really good and more complete idea of the issues that they're facing when they have what you might call your day in court with the independent decision makers. The third main set of changes that the CMA is making is to reconstruct the remedies process a little bit. Essentially, there are going to be some new hooks put in so that there are triggers for the parties to think about talking about remedies at earlier stages in the process. When you get to the later part of this process, after the CMA has provisionally decided whether there are competition concerns or not, the CMA's try to put a little bit more structure, I think, about the process to assess remedies. So there's going to be a sort of more defined start to the process through a sort of formal remedies form, which is going to clarify the kind of information that parties should be providing. And then there's going to be more interaction throughout the process. And then there's going to be a more defined endpoint towards the end of the investigation where the CMA says, look, we've been talking about remedies, you know our concerns. If you want to tell us anything else, either in terms of offering a new remedy or offering us information or evidence which you think should change our mind on those concerns, you have to do it by X date. So there's a bit more clarity around when the music is going to stop.
Got it. Thanks, Colin. And I want to go back to especially the first point that you mentioned, which sounds like a lot of that goes to increased engagement, increased back and forth. And I know I hear from clients a lot a concern that the CMA is kind of a black box where information comes in and it takes a long time to get a readout of where they are. Do you think that we're in a world with these reforms where parties can have more of a back and forth discussion with the CMA where they get more information as the process goes?
I think that's right. I think when you look at all of the different ways in which the CMA is changing the process, it's definitely going to provide for more engagement and I think probably a higher quality of engagement as well. In addition to these sort of formal changes that the CMA is making to the more formal structures in the investigation, one of the other really interesting aspects of the guidance is that the CMA is highlighting the benefit of informal means of communication. So it's saying that it's going to reopen some of the informal lines of communications which were perhaps used a bit more frequently in the past. So what they're saying is, you know, we will try and give you more in the way of update calls with the case team so we can let you know how the group's thinking is evolving, if we can do that. And they're also reopening the possibility of having economist-to-economist meetings where the party's economic advisors will be able to sit down and engage with the CMA's economic advisors directly in cases where there are sort of complex theories of harm or issues around economic evidence gathering, to have a kind of less formal exchange on what the key issues are in the case. So I think overall, we see quite a significant improvement in the amount and quality of engagement. I think it is still important to be realistic about what the case is ultimately going to turn on. And I think in any CMA investigation, it's clear that the case will still turn on the evidence. So you have these great new opportunities for advocacy, which you can use to influence the CMA's thinking about how the case should be run and what evidence should be gathered and how the evidence base should be characterized. But I think it's really, really important not to think that the CMA is going to change its position and all of a sudden that sort of uncorroborated oral advocacy that might be delivered in these meetings is all of a sudden going to be given much more weight. I don't think that's the case. I spend a lot of time over the years working with CMA panel members and they were a sort of constant refrain that you would hear is, well, that's all very good, but where is the evidence for it? They're really, really good at looking underneath what they've been told and trying to work out what basis there is for it or not. And look, that's not going to change.
Thanks, Colin. And everything you've talked about so far really goes to how the process is being maybe somewhat streamlined for the merging parties. But obviously, there are third parties that are relevant to these merger investigations, customers, competitors, complainants. Are there anything in these reforms that impact the way that those parties are going to deal with the CMA?
That's a really good question, Jen, because I think one of the most significant points that the CMA has been trying to get out as it's been working on these reforms is that the voice of third parties in this process just shouldn't be lost. And that's particularly the case because, you know, in a lot of cases, you have third parties who might be smaller, they might be consumer organizations, you know, they're not legally represented in quite the same way as the emerging parties. So the CMA is really worried that those third parties might struggle to have a voice. So look, the guidance makes clear that those third parties will also be getting more time with the decision makers as well. There's also the sort of new mechanism that's been introduced, which is the possibility of joint hearings between third parties and the emerging parties. And I think that is a really interesting development, particularly in the sort of era we're in now, where we're looking a lot at cases in the digital sector, where you have quite frequently concerns being raised around, you know, technical interoperability, for example. And this is a kind of new mechanism for the CMA to get everyone in the room at the same time and have a discussion about the sort of ins and outs of that technical interoperability to try and understand exactly to what extent those concerns are merited or not.
Got it. And sounds like a lot of increased engagement for everybody, more open dialogue, more open meetings. But what about documents? Are there any change here to the UK's access to file rules?
No, Jen, that's one area that remains unchanged. And as the consultation document that the CMA published when it issued its proposed reforms made clear, this is an area where the CMA has had a really good think about its practice, given the criticism that it's faced in recent years. And essentially, where it's come out is that the process as it stands at the moment on that front seems to be working well. It is an issue that's been challenged a number of times before the appellate court in the UK, the Competition Appeal Tribunal. In a number of recent years, the Competition Appeal Tribunal has said on a number of occasions, look, the way it works at the moment is essentially sufficient to ensure that the party's rights of defence are respected. On top of that, the CMA has said, well, you know, if we were going to allow for access to file, we think it would significantly extend the timeline of a merger investigation. And the CMA thinks there were two problems with that, essentially. Firstly, it thinks that it might not be possible to have that longer process within the existing statutory timeline, because when the existing statutory timelines were set up, access to file wasn't contemplated. And CMA investigations do generally tend to take not as much time as an EC merger investigation, for example, where there is access to file. That feeds into the second conclusion the CMA has is, look, in the absence of any systemic failings, we just don't see any policy basis to try and extend the timeline for these investigations, because if things are generally working well at the moment and these cases are generally taking quite a lot of time, so, you know, we see them generally taking over 12 months from signing to the final antitrust decision, in that world, we don't see a basis to extend things to allow for access to file.
That's interesting, Colin. And I want to go back to the comment you made before on remedies and the changes here, because we know from recent cases that the CMA is playing a really pivotal role in these complex multi-jurisdictional merger reviews. And a lot has been said and written about the challenges parties face in those reviews. We've talked about it a lot on the podcast. And where you have a global remedies package, it's getting harder to have something that clearly satisfies all the competition regulators. So if you are working on a deal like that, or you have one in the hopper, are the reforms going to help you with that massive coordination exercise?
I think so. One of the things the CMA has really tried to do in this consultation process leading up to the new reforms is try to think about why parties aren't engaging on remedies at an earlier stage in the process. So in Brussels with the European Commission, for example, it has been a bit more common than it has been to talk to the regulator about remedies before the competition questions have still been decided. In the UK, there's been a real taboo, I think, about talking about remedies before the group has reached their provisional decision on whether there's a competition concern or not. And that can be difficult because it means that the period of time that you have to talk about a remedy can be quite truncated. And that's particularly problematic where you might want to have a remedy that's a bit more complex in nature. So what the CMA is trying to do now is trying to build in hooks, I think, to say, look, we are open to talking about remedies at an earlier stage. It's also trying to build in explicit avenues of feedback. So it can say, look, this is our current thinking on the competition concern. Maybe you should think about whether you want to come in and talk to us at remedies at that stage. So I think it opens up this much broader runway to engage with the CMA about potentially complex remedies. And that obviously should make the process of alignment across different jurisdictions a bit easier than it is at the moment. I think it's important to be clear, however, on how the CMA is likely to use this broader runway. I think what it's saying is, look, there's going to be more time and more scope and more feedback. But if you don't approach that in the right way, then we're probably not going to engage. So I think parties who think about these new opportunities as kind of additional time to get a lowball remedy off their chests and on the CMA's agenda, I think that's probably just going to be a waste of time. The CMA's been relatively clear throughout this process that that isn't how the process should be used. And in fact, it might just refuse to engage at all if the remedy doesn't reach that threshold level of credibility.
Well, I mean, despite that, overall, it sounds like these reforms are certainly moving in a direction that will help businesses that are navigating through this process. If you are a company with a deal that might go before the CMA and you're thinking about how you might use these changes strategically, what advice would you give? Where can parties really make changes to what they're doing to take advantage of these changes?
I think that's a really, really important first point, Jen, which is that some of these changes may not be that straightforward for the CMA to operationalize. So I think there is a real challenge, first of all, to see how the CMA can actually implement some of these changes in practice, because the real benefit of most of the changes is going to come if they can be really, really executed in a way that's going to be beneficial both to the CMA and the emerging parties. And in some cases, that's going to involve turning around practice, which has been relatively well established for a number of years. So I think, you know, culturally, as much as anything else, there's going to be a bit of a challenge for the CMA to overcome here. From our perspective, what should businesses be doing to make the most of this? I think you've really got to think about your strategy quite carefully up front, and to think about what your commercial objectives are, both in terms of timing and an outcome. It's going to continue to be important to prepare for the full range of theories of harm that the CMA is going to be thinking about. And these are, of course, you know, as we've discussed before, not always the same as those that are typically considered by the Commission and the US agencies. And then when we're thinking about these theories of harm, it's going to be really important to properly assess the strengths and weaknesses of the evidence base to support the path towards clearance, because that's really going to influence how you should be engaging with the CMA. Where competition concerns arise or could arise, getting complex remedies over the line is going to continue to be greatly aided by upfront planning, expert remedy design, and by the kind of early and open engagement with the CMA that these changes should really facilitate. And then, like we've talked about a little bit earlier, you know, regulators are working more and more with each other today. They're exchanging information. They're talking about their enforcement strategies extensively in these parallel agency reviews. And in that kind of case, it's really important to be fully joined up globally, but also to have a sort of game plan that accounts for the local differences we see between the FTC, the Commission, the CMA. And as part of that, businesses should be really thinking about where divergence risks might arise, and to mitigate the potential deal impact of those risks with careful process and substantive planning.
So we're getting kind of to the end of our time, Colin, but I know you've talked about a lot of the big picture, the most important changes. Is there anything else in these reforms that clients just may want to be aware of?
So in relation to the reforms themselves, the CMA has done a little bit of tidying up as well on some of the documents that are associated with merger control investigations. So one document that has changed is its waiver template, which is the standard waiver that it uses to exchange information with other authorities. And the changes there are quite technical, but the key point is essentially the CMA is really, really keen, having consulted upon these changes, to use a standard waiver in all cases. So what that means is merging parties should think about these waivers, I think, essentially on a take it or leave it basis. The CMA has signaled that it's going to be quite unwilling to engage in case-by-case discussions on the precise wording of a waiver. So I think that's an important development for clients to be aware of. On top of that, the merger notice has changed a little bit as well, and that will change the information that a party notifying a deal is required to provide to the CMA. The changes are not of course, as extensive as those changes that are being contemplated in the US at the moment. There are tweaks around the margins because merging parties are already required to provide quite a lot of extensive information to the CMA. But look, I think they're important for clients thinking about filings to be aware of, because the sort of goalposts have changed a little bit in that extent. One other really interesting reform that was announced at the same time were changes to what's known as the de minimis guidance in the UK. And that's essentially a mechanism that allows the CMA to exercise a discretion not to find competition problems where the markets involved in a merger are not of sufficient importance. And essentially that is that's a tool that the CMA uses to deprioritize smaller cases, both in deciding whether to call them in for investigation in the first place, but also deciding whether they should give rise to competition concerns in phase one. And what the CMA has done there is it's raised the thresholds and it's given itself a bit more flexibility to be able to use that tool a bit more extensively. And I think that's really interesting because it's part of a broader signal that shows that the CMA remains really keen to focus all of its efforts and resources on the most problematic cases. And what that might mean in future is probably some of these smaller cases will fall by the wayside a little bit.
Picking up on your point about the form in the UK, as you alluded to, we are expecting our revised USHSR form really any minute now. And so we'll talk about that on the podcast for sure as soon as that is published and see where the FTC has come out. But just to wrap up, Colin, I mean, we have been talking about the merger process specifically, but post-Brexit, the UK have been busy, busy bees and looking at all kinds of different things. So can you talk to us a little bit about what other changes and reforms we might be seeing in the UK in the near term?
Yeah, so there's a really, really significant piece of legislation, Jen, that's making its way through the UK Parliament at the moment, the Digital Markets, Competition and Consumers Bill. And that piece of legislation makes a couple of other really significant changes to how mergers are going to be looked at. For example, introduces this new fast-track mechanism that allows parties to move more easily directly to a phase two investigation. So if you had a case that's quite complicated and you think realistically it's never going to reach a phase one outcome, it's going to be a bit easier in future to just move straight to a phase two investigation. One other really interesting aspect of that bill is a new mechanism to pause a phase two investigation to allow for the parties and the CMA to talk about remedies. And that's intended to incentivize remedies discussions at an earlier stage. So there are two other really significant changes that could change the way that phase two processes are run. So that legislation is expected to receive what we call royal assent here in the UK in the next few weeks and enter into force later this year. And we'll be talking about that, I'm sure, and the other aspects of that piece of legislation, which is really significant for all kinds of other reasons, in one of our future podcasts, I'm sure.
I am sure we will, Colin. And I think that is probably the perfect place to wrap up for today. But thank you so much for sharing your insights into these new reforms and giving us your take on what this means for businesses who find themselves subject to one of these UK merger processes. For those of you listening, if you want to find out more about any of the points Colin and I have discussed today, you can take a look at a blog we published on the reforms and keep an eye or an ear out for an upcoming podcast on the Digital Markets, Competition and Consumers Act. For now, we wish you all a great day and thank you for listening to Essential Antitrust.